Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC local radio.
And 40 years later, I still get occasionally pulled up in a tram somewhere in Melbourne, and a little old lady will say to me, "Oh, you're the man from Country Practice." I'd say, yeah, but do you remember anything I was saying? And this little old lady said, "Yes, you were talking about land rights. I remember that well." And I thought, there you go. Country Practice was the biggest audience I ever got a message about Aboriginal land rights across to, both locally and internationally. You know, it worked out as a pretty good little trick.
In conversation with Professor Gary Foley. This is part two of my conversation with Uncle Gary Foley. Part one is available on your podcast app. In our previous episode, we discussed his advocacy in the 1960s and 70s. Something else Gary Foley helped start was the National Black Theatre, which kicked off in 1972. Their first show was basically black, and this turned into the first all-Indigenous TV show. And a warning, there is some strong language that may cause offence.
Is it a bat? Is it a crow? Is it the Flying Doctor? No, it's Superbong, strange visitor from a northern tribe who came to the city possessing powers far beyond those of mortal Kuris, faster than a killer boomerang and able to leap over tall gum trees in a single bound. Superbong uses his secret identity as mild-mannered Aboriginal ex-boxing champion Lionel Mouse to fight a never-ending battle against racism wherever it may be found.
Hi guys, seen any racism around?
Not today, bud.
Oh, looks like someone's in need of help from the Artful Abbo. I'll think I'll race into the toilet of this hotel and change.
What's up, bud?
They don't allow blacks in that pub.
Gary Foley wrote the script for that debut episode of Basically Black on ABC TV back in 1973. Let's return to my conversation with Professor Gary Foley. There is one other aspect of what was started and was transformative in that era in the 1970s, and that's the black theatre. And I guess leading from that, the kind of first foray into television with Basically Black. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why that element of what came out of that era of shaking up the arts, of finding a way to tell our stories, of using humour and satire to push a political point, are also a really important part of that movement.
Yeah, well, I think it must have been in around 1971 or something. I was in Canberra for some reason, and Bob Mazza, who I'd known previously from Melbourne, Bob Mazza was in town, and he was in this theatre show called Jack Charles is Up and Fighting. And it was with a theatre company called Nindasana Theatre that Bob had set up in Melbourne, and consisted of Jack Charles, Bob Mazza, and this European actor, Ollie Lewinsky, I think was his name. It was a three-man show, and Bob talked me into going and having a look at it on the campus of ANU. And I'd never been to a theatre in my life up to that moment. I arrived a bit late, and I walked into the back of this big, I remember it was a big old sort of tin shed sort of theatre, and I could hear this booming voice coming from somewhere. And when I was able to see the stage, way up ahead on the stage was this tiny little black man out of whom was coming this extraordinary voice. You know, I didn't know anything about this at the time, but I said to myself, that sounds like a Shakespearean voice to me. And it was Jack Charles. And I sat down and I watched this show, and it blew me away. I thought, how fantastic. You know, here's yet a different medium again through which we might push a political message. And it dawned on me what Bob Mazur had been trying to talk to me about, that precise sort of idea prior to that. But suddenly I saw exactly what he meant. And so a little while later, I think it was 6 months later or something, Bob Mazur bought his, or opened up across the road from the Aboriginal Legal Service, opened up the National Black Theatre, rented this building, put a sign out the front, National Black Theatre, looking for actors. And they began to develop a show for the Nimrod Theatre in Sydney. And this is at its, right at the beginnings of the old Nimrod Theatre. It's one of the alternative theatres of Sydney at the time, progressive theatre, I suppose they call it these days. And Bob was rehearsing a show there, and he talked me into going and having a look at the rehearsal. I didn't realise it at the time, but he was being shifty. They needed another cast member. And so I'm sitting there in the bleachers watching them rehearse, and I must have laughed or something. And Bob looked up and he said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I could do that better than that." And Bob said, "Come on then, bastard, come down and do it." And I said, "Oh, not to knock back a challenge like that when I was young and silly." Went down. I don't think I did it better, but next thing I know, Bob had roped me into being an extra cast member. And so I wrote him a couple of extra sketches, and we began our show. I think it was in November 1972 at the Nimrod. Amazingly enough, we played the packed houses. Now, this is a bunch of black fellas out of Redfern with a very intensely political and confrontational show for white middle-class people, and all of our audience was white middle-class people, you know, and they loved it.
Even after 200 years, you never get used to it.
Welcome to colour television.
Yes, folks, it's the National Black Theatre in... And starring the Australian All Blacks, Bob Mazur, Gary Foley, Aileen Corpus, Zach Martin, and Bindi Williams.
Good morning. I am a human being.
Cut!
Now listen, you guys. These are proud and sensitive people, okay?
Okay.
They've had a pretty rough time, but we're going to start treating them as human beings, right?
Right.
Right.
Cue the bong. I mean, it lacks sophistication, doesn't it?
Hadn't really thought of that.
Now, take this bloke I ran into the other night. He was a real expert at the old contemporary. Beautiful style he had. Funny thing, he was a darkie too. From Redfern, he said. You'd never believe what he did.
Here, I'll show you.
Yeah, now, take hold of my arm.
Like this?
Uh-huh. Now, twist it up behind my back.
Lovely.
Jackie said his name was. Do you know him?
Nah, but I'm from La Perouse myself.
Pity. Nice bloke. Now, push me forward so I'm bending over. Oh, that's it, sir. Oh, you've got the hang of it now. Now, give us a good kick up the kyber.
Ow!
There, sir. Feeling better now?
Oh, geez, I'd reckon. That's what I call a real healthy contempt for authority. Gee, hey, what'd you do with him after he did all that to you, eh?
What do you think I did? I took him down to the station and kicked his guts in. Come on.
I mean, it was extraordinary, and we played to packed houses. And on the final night, the last night of our performance, was the night of the election of Gough Whitlam. So we did our show that night. We set up all these TV screens in the foyer, and we invited the audience to join us for the night as we watched the election results come in. And, you know, for anyone who wasn't around when Whitlam got elected, it was quite a stunning moment in Australian history. An intense feeling, sadly, which didn't last long, but nevertheless. And so we finished at the Nimrod, and we had a meeting at the theatre the next week, and Bob said, where in Australia needs this show the most? And every one of us in Queensland. at the time on the East Coast, we thought Queensland was the pits in terms of racism, and the racist Queensland Act and old Yogi Yogi Peters and all the rest of it. So Bob bought an old Bedford bus, and off we set, painted a big sign along the side of it, National Black Theatre on Tour, which was probably a mistake. As soon as we got across the border in Queensland, every copper from the border to Townsville sort of harassed us along the way. But we played our first performance at the Innisfail Festival of Arts, and we did the best show we ever did of Basically Black, the original stage version. We did the best show we ever did the name's slipped me now. I'm getting old. I have a memory loss, but the Reserve outside of Cairns, outside of Townsville, I think it was. No, Cairns. And where the whole community turned out. The white manager of the reserve, this was still controlled by a Queensland government at the time, the manager went around and knocked at all the houses on the reserve and told them that day, don't go to the theatre show tonight. These are black power radicals from Sydney, you know, and they're dangerous. And couldn't have done a better PR for us. The entire community turned out. We did our show. They yelled for more. Those among us who thought they could sing sung a few songs and ran out of that. And then we said, anyone here sing? And then people got up out of the audience. We had a big party. It was the best show we ever did. Unfortunately, a week later, we went broke in Cairns. And we hitchhiked back to Sydney. Bob came and said to us, ABC TV wants to do a series based on it. And we said, oh, yeah. And so we signed up to do a pilot. The ABC said, we'll do a pilot and see how it goes. And so I wrote a series of new sketches. I wrote the Superboom sketches for Zach Martin. And a little secret of this, of Superboom, is that that was partially inspired in me from reading Phantom comics when I was a kid. You know, the Phantom walks into a bar and asks for a glass of milk, you know, in disguise, walks into a bar, glass of milk, please. All the tough guys laugh and the Phantom sort of beats them up. That was in, there's a part of a scene in Basically Black, the TV version, that's based on a Phantom sketch. But, it was a very effective thing. I mean, even these days, I've seen younger generation of Aboriginal media people when they show Basically Black on ABC, a younger generation almost not going to say the name Superboom. Say it, folks, Superboom. It was satire. That's the beauty of satire.
I can't talk about the acting without also mentioning that you then went on to make some appearances in some mainstream shows, and I'm thinking particularly of your time in A Country Practice, because at that time we just didn't see Aboriginal people on the screen, and I remember watching it back in the day, and it was actually really something to see you on the screen in a very popular television comedy series or drama series.
And playing a preacher, no less.
Yes, you certainly weren't being typecast, that's for sure.
Well, there's a story behind that. At the time, I got a phone call out of the blue one day from James Davin, who was the boss and owner of Country Practice. He rang me up one day and asked me if I was interested in doing a guest slot. And I said to him, only on two conditions. Number one, I want to choose the character I play. And number two, I want to write my own dialogue. And he agreed, you know, and I'm the only person who appeared on Country Practice who was allowed to do that ever. But what had been going on that led me to say that to him, I'd been involved in this intense argument with this bunch of lunatic fringe fundamentalist American Christians who were proselytising in Central Australia, and they were going around using all sorts of shifty methods. They'd train up a couple of local mob who speak the language and get them to then, you know, go and preach the word. And the word they were preaching was that land rights is the work of the devil. And if you advocate land rights, you will go to hell. And so I got into a bit of an argument with this bunch of people because at the time, even though I've been a lifelong atheist, I was at the time the chairperson of the Aboriginal Advisory Group to the Australian Council of Churches. And so these Americans then immediately accused the Australian Council of Churches of being communist and communist influence. And so I was arguing with them as the chairperson of that publicly. And so they ended up putting my picture on one of their cover of one of their magazines and saying that I was essentially the devil incarnate. And so I was pretty, let's put it this way, I was pissed off with them at the time. And so when Jim Davin rings me up and says, you want a part in country practice? I said, yeah, as long as I can play an Aboriginal pastor, an Aboriginal pastor who advocates land rights. And so that's what I played on country practice, you know. And 40 years later, I still get occasionally pulled up in a tram somewhere in Melbourne, and a little old lady will say to me, oh, you're the man from country practice. I'd say, yeah, but do you remember anything I was saying on country practice? And this little old lady said, yes, you were talking about land rights. I remember that well. And I thought, there you go. Country practice was the biggest audience I ever got a message about Aboriginal land rights across to, both locally and internationally. You know, it worked out as a pretty good little trick. And I thank James Davin for that. I think he might have passed now, but he gave me that opportunity. And I don't know why. He didn't know me before that. He'd only seen me on telly or something. But the day I started shooting country practice, he turned up on set, and Shane Porteous and all these other actors, main actors in the show, were quite surprised. They said, God, it's God. I said, where's God? That bloke over there, Jim Davin. I said, what's he doing here? They said, we don't know. He never comes on set. He's here for you. So that was interesting. That was an interesting moment, I suppose.
If they weren't enough strings to one person's bow, of course, from being expelled from school when you were 15, you are now a professor at a university, and you went and got a degree at Melbourne University in history. You already had a pretty impressive CV. What drew you into studying formally and teaching in the academy?
Well, when I got expelled from Maxwell High School, one of the worst things that did to me was it turned me off education for 30 years. You know, I lost belief. I lost any sort of belief in education as a path to go. It's something that I profoundly regret nowadays, because it took me 30 years before I finally went to uni. And I finally went to uni because somebody at Melbourne Uni insulted me. I'd been guest lecturing in a couple of subjects at Melbourne Uni for years. You know, they bring me in. I'm the real thing. I can talk about this stuff they've been learning about from a first-hand account and all this sort of stuff. So I'll be giving guest lectures. And one day I realised that my archive, stuff that I've been collecting, hoarding for 50 years, was in my back shed in Northcote in Melbourne. And I realised the shed had a hole in the roof. So I freaked out and I went to Melbourne Uni to the person in the history department who I'd been guest lecturing for. I said, listen, I just need a room somewhere in this vast campus where I can safely store my archive. I said, I'm happy to go through index and collate and index the whole thing and make it accessible and available to students as a resource, you know, in return. This person looked at me and said, I'm sorry, Gary, we can't help you. And I said, oh, why might that be? And they said, you don't have any formal academic qualification. And I looked at him and I said, well, I'll come and get you a Mickey Mouse little bit of paper. It mustn't be too difficult if you've got one. And a few months later, I turned up as a first-year undergrad mature-age student in the class of this very person. And I was interested to see who they were going to get to do the lecture that I normally did, you know, in that class. But they eventually asked me to do it, and I did it graciously, just if for no other reason to show my fellow students in my class who was the better history lecturer, even though I didn't have that little bit of paper. But, you know, I did one subject in history when I started as an undergrad. I did one subject in cultural studies, which I thought was something else. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be, but I excelled in it. And I did one subject in computer science because I'd become very interested in computers, and I'd taught myself in the days before the internet how to code and various stuff like that. That's what led me to setting up the oldest Aboriginal history website in the world, still going. But it was an interesting experience. When I first went there, and this happens to a lot of people my generation, I suppose, who go to uni late, one of the first things they say to you, oh, you're going to have credit for life experience. I said, what's that mean? They said, oh, you don't have to do all the work. We can give you credits for, you know, you having been what you are. I said, I don't want credits. I'm here to prove something. Not necessarily to you lot, but to me. I said, I want to prove to myself I can do this. I don't want no, you know, advantages over anyone else. And so I didn't even get ab study. I did it off my own bat, and I ended up with my degree, first class honours in history and cultural studies, a double whammer, and I won the Vice Chancellor's Award at the University of Melbourne for my PhD. It was an interesting challenge, and the only regret I have about it all now is that I didn't do it when I was young. I coulda and I shoulda. But if I'd have done it when I was young, I might have ended up a vice chancellor, which would be the worst case scenario. So I'm better off as just a mere professor who teaches.
You're listening to my conversation with Aboriginal campaigner, rights advocate, history professor, former actor, and a man with a very cheeky sense of humour, Professor Gary Foley.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Local Radio.
This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, ABCRN, Radio Australia, on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. You'll hear more from my chat with Uncle Gary Foley after some music from No Fixed Address. That was No Fixed Address with I Can't Stand and Look.
This is Speaking Out.
That's the key to it all, keeping connected to country.
On ABC Local Radio.
When Professor Gary Foley read his ASIO file, he was quite amused and engaged. He says the spies kept better minutes than he had, so he found his file a useful record of his life. It was also a good reference for his PhD and led to some very interesting historical discoveries.
Well, I mean, I think I've said before that, I mean, anyone who's wondering if you've got an ASIO file or are in the process of acquiring an ASIO file, then all you got to do is wait. It used to be all you had to do was wait for 30 years and then all Australian government documents, including ASIO files, revert to the National Archive, where not only can you read it, everyone else in the world can read it. So I found when I started reading my ASIO file, found out all sorts of interesting things. The first was that many of the spooks who infiltrated meetings that I was at actually seemed to have kept better minutes of what occurred and who said what than the official stuff we were keeping. So, I mean, you know, for someone like me who didn't keep a diary in those days and who can't remember most of those days anyway, they're a handy reference guide of where I was on any given occasion and what I was doing and what I said at certain meetings and all this. Equally interesting was the people who were informing on me. I discovered very quickly that the main person who kept on putting ASIO onto me was old Barry Dexter, who was the first head of the first Department of Aboriginal Affairs under Whitlam, but who had earlier been appointed by Harold Holt in the immediate aftermath of the 67 referendum to this, the first Aboriginal advisory group to the federal government, three white men, Barry Dexter, Nugget Coombs, and old Bill Stanner, the anthropologist. And so Barry Dexter took a keen interest in the Black Power movement and felt incredibly threatened by it. And so he was the main person who kept on putting ASIO onto me. And so as I was reading this while I was doing my PhD, I was also writing about the period when I knew Barry Dexter, and I didn't realise that he was the main person dobbing me in. And so I thought one day, and then I remembered that one of his grand nieces or somebody had been in a class of mine, and so I contacted him and I said to him, is your Uncle Barry still alive? And she said, yeah. I said, give me his number, because I thought to myself, this old bloke, he's probably old as the hills now, and his wife's probably died, and he's probably vegetating in some miserable nursing home in Canberra somewhere. And I was right. He was. And so I rung him up because I thought to myself, if he's in that situation, he's probably aching to talk to somebody. And so I rang him up out of the blue and said, hey, Baz, remember me, Gary Foley? He said, oh, yes, I remember you. I said, listen, I'm a historian these days. I'm interested in having a yarn here. Can I come up and see you? He said, yeah, sure. So I went up and I wanted to get one thing out of the road when I met him. I said to him, why did you think that we were trying to kill you? And he said, ASIO told me. And I said, Barry, as mad as we were, we never wanted to kill you. Why would we want to kill you? As silly, crazy, the craziest of us was, none of us ever wanted to kill you. And he said, ASIO showed me. And I said, what did they show you? He said, they showed me the telephone transcripts. I said, oh, yeah. I said, who was talking? He said, oh, Sammy and Dennis. I said, that was Dennis Walker and his mates in Brisbane. That wasn't us in Redfern. That wasn't me. I wasn't party to any conversation like that. And he's, but I had to live under Commonwealth police protection in my house for 3 years. I said, you're kidding. I said, well, that wasn't us. I mean, you know, that's, I feel sorry for you. That shouldn't have happened. ASIO's sending you up the wrong tree, mate. Anyway, we started yarning after that and talking about the old days. And remarkably, we found ourselves, in terms of our interpretation at the time we spoke some 30, 40 years later, we found ourselves agreeing on so many things, our interpretation of how things went in the long run. And I ended up becoming really close friends with him. And he, well, in the course of saying all this to me, he accidentally let it slip that he'd written a book, because I said to him, you should write a book, Baz. He said, oh, I did. And I said, what are you talking about? I never read it. He said, nobody'd publish it. I said, hang on. Are you telling me that you wrote a manuscript and nobody'd publish it? He said, that's correct. I said, I don't believe it. Where is it? Where's your manuscript? He said, it's in the Institute of Aboriginal Studies archive. I won't let anyone look at it. And I looked at him and he looked at me and I said, let me look at it. And I mean, this is me, first time we've spoken to each other for 40 years. I'm the guy who he thought wanted to kill him. And he looked at me and said, okay. And so I got it out of the Institute and I only read the first five chapters and I realised that this was an incredibly historically significant and important document. Here's a guy who was the number one man in the bureaucracy in Canberra to do with Aboriginal affairs, the number one man for a decade, from about 1966 to almost 1976. He was the first head of the first Department of Aboriginal Affairs. He's the guy who recruited Charlie Perkins into the public service and many other Aboriginal people. And he's no insignificant figure in history. And some of the contentions that he makes, and he's documented everything. It's exquisitely documented. The only problem with the manuscript he gave to me was instead of referencing any document he was citing, he actually typed the entire document into the manuscript so that the manuscript was about a foot high when I got it. And my associate at the time, Edwina Howell, Dr. Edwina Howell, and I edited the thing. It was a massive job. But we finally, it took us almost 3 years to get the thing published. But when we did, Barry's daughters had been telling me for some time, they kept on saying, the only reason this old man's staying alive is to see this book, because I'd said to him, I want you to have your moment in the sun, mate. Don't die before I publish this. I want you to be there at the launch. And he hung on. I think he was about 96. And it was only a few months before he died. We managed to have an opening in the old Legislative Assembly in the old Parliament House. All of his old mates, all the old welfare officers and assimilationists and people we used to hate in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, we invited all of them. They all came. They were all shocked to see me there. And he got his moment in the sun and he was as happily as Larry. And he died not long after and I went and spoke at his funeral, you know. And it's one of the great ironies. 50 years ago or more, Barry Dexter was one of my greatest enemies. I didn't want to kill him, but he was nevertheless my greatest political enemy, I considered. And then just before he died, we made peace, you know, and I'm glad we did.
Do you think this means you've mellowed in your older age? And how do you compare the elder statesman that you're considered today by so much of the First Nations community with the young political radical you were back in the 1970s?
It irritates me to be considered as such, but...
I thought it might, but you are, unfortunately.
It's unfortunate. No, it's sort of... I've got one foot in the grave. I've already gone blind to the point where I can no longer read and write. I'm going deaf. My lungs are conked out. And all I'm trying to do in my old age is last as long as Chicka Dixon did. Chicka Dixon was one of my great mentors. I had two great mentors. And that was Bruce McGuinness and Chicka Dixon. And Chicka lasted till he was 82. And I've only got emphysema. He had the trifecta. He had mesothelioma, asbestosis, and emphysema. And he lasted till he was 82. And they didn't call him the fox for nothing, folks.
We talked about that heady days in those heady days in the 1970s where we had the tent embassy, the start of the community controlled organizations, the exchanges intellectually with forces and movements overseas. I was wondering what your reflections are on where we are now, and particularly in the light of the referendum last year. And just wondering what your perspective is on where we are as a nation and where we are in terms of our political movements today.
I try not to reflect on where we are today, but in terms of the referendum, I predicted well in advance of the referendum what the result was going to be. As I said at the time, you didn't need to be a clairvoyant to know that a no vote was more likely after we've had just had 40 years or more of history and culture wars. And throughout it all is that underlying heartbeat of white Australian racism. That's been a factor ever since Federation. You know, the greatest obstacle confronting Aboriginal people today in Australia is what it's always been. And that's the underlying white racism, the big elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about or even wants to concede exists. And yet it's a significant factor. And it's there in the results of the referendum. You know, 60 years ago, the last referendum we had the biggest yes vote in Australian history. And it didn't change anything. In fact, in New South Wales, it made things worse when they closed down the old welfare board. So, but what came out of the failure of the 67 referendum was the Black Power movement. And what potentially will come out of the mess of the referendum is a new generation of young activists who hopefully will look at the track record of my generation and those and the track record of those who advocated the referendum, and that younger generation should say to themselves, well, you older mob, your tactics and strategies failed. That's what we did after the 67 referendum, my generation. We looked at the tactics and strategies of the older generation who'd pushed so hard for the referendum that they'd promised us would change things, and it didn't. And when it didn't, we said, okay, we'll go our own way. We'll find our own solution, see if we can find our own way forward. And that's what has to happen next. And as far as I'm concerned, in Melbourne, we've got the significant signs of that happening with a younger generation, probably my grandkids' generation, who are emerging, or even younger than them, who are emerging and seeing, you know, looking at the failures of the previous generation's tactics and trying to find a different way forward for themselves, you know. And that's the way it's got to be, because they're the ones who are going to inhabit the world that they create in the same way as we've had to, my generation's had to inhabit, you know, the world that we created and lost. But might I say the only mistake of my generation, I think, we've set out believing that we could change the world. And we did. We did change our world. Our big mistake was once we changed our world, we took our eyes off the ball and the bastards changed it back. So the next generation, you believe that you can change the world because you can through effort and through being united and through developing, a cooperative spirit with others, like-minded, like you. You can change it, but when you do change it, don't take your eye off the ball. Don't let the bastard change it back this time. You're running out of time anyway.
Yours has been an extraordinary and very full life. We've covered just a myriad of things that you've been involved in and achieved. But when you look back on the things you've done, what personally gives you the greatest sense of satisfaction? What are you most proud of?
I probably think of a lot of things I'm not proud of, but I don't know. There's been one, I mean, the embassy is obviously a big moment. But, you know, the development of the early community control legal and health services, I think, was a significant thing. I think that the effort that governments have made to undermine those very sort of organisations over the past 50 years is an indication of how strong those organisations were in the beginning, you know, that they were seen as such a threat by subsequent governments of all political persuasions, you know. And so the development of those early organisations, but I think that the Northland Secondary College battle in Melbourne was one of the more interesting battles I was part of, because that was the first time in my life I'd ever led a battle by a group of people that was comprised 90% of non-Aboriginal people. I mean, you know, when Jeff Kennett, the Premier of Victoria, closed down hundreds of schools when he was Premier, one of those schools was a place called Northland Secondary College, where an enormous number of disadvantaged kids who weren't performing in the mainstream sausage system of the education system were dumped in that school. And a dedicated group of teachers and community people came together to create a unique environment at that school that made all deprived and disadvantaged students feel at home and feel as part of it and actually begin to academically perform, including my son, who'd been sent to live with me after he had been deemed the most notorious truant in the New South Wales education system when he was 13. He was sent to live with me, and when I put him in Northland Secondary College for the first time in his life, he began to perform academically, you know, and I didn't have to pay him to go to school. And within 6 months of him starting to do that, Jeff Kennett comes along and closes down the school. I was in the same boat, I discovered, as a lot of other parents out in that area that served that school. And it was mostly poor white people, refugees, immigrants, families that had difficulty coping, you know. And so when Kennett closed down the school, they had a big meeting at the school that night. I was the only person in the room, I think, who'd had any sort of experience of politics. And so I got up and made a, you know, a trademark speech. And they sort of carried me out of the school all on their shoulders. And next thing I know, I'm leading this battle against the state government. And I look behind me, and because only 10% of the school were Aboriginal students, 90% of the school were non-Aboriginal. And 90% of the people waving the pitchforks behind me were non-Indigenous people. And we fought a three-year battle against the Kennett government, against all odds, when we got sold out by everybody in power and consequence. The Labor government was in power in Canberra at the time. They undermined us to help Jeff Kennett, a Liberal Premier, you know. And so, but we still won in the end. The full bench of the Supreme Court ordered Kennett to reopen the school. And we won a momentary battle. The only tragedy was that the kids for whom we had specifically fought the battle, by then, after 3 years, had been lost to education. And whilst I predicted during the early court cases to do with that battle, I predicted that if Kennett didn't reopen the school, some of those kids were in such a situation that some of them would die, and some of them did.
Professor Dr. Gary Foley, it's been such a privilege to talk with you. You've been such an inspiration and a really important figure, particularly intellectually, for my generation and the generations coming behind me. It's an extraordinary legacy, and I just want to thank you so much for everything you've done to show us the way, your tireless energy, the many ways you've shown us that we should be trying to make a difference, and for spending time with us on Speaking Out. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Professor Gary Foley. He's a professor at Victoria University's Mundani Bullock Indigenous Academic Unit. And to finish, here's a nice bit of archive from when he was invited on stage by the English rock band The Clash during their Australian shows in 1982.
It's Gary Foley. I'm a black Australian. I'm here to tell you tonight a little bit about what's happening with Aboriginal people in this country. The brothers here from Clash said we could tell you a little bit, because this is not just a night for music, it's a night for understanding people who are oppressed. And in this country, it's Aboriginal people who are oppressed. Our people lived in this country for 50,000 years. And everything was cool until 200 years ago. Some bloke by the name of Captain Cook come out here. Now 800 million Aboriginal people lived and died here before any white man come to this country. When you arrived, when white men arrived in this country, they either shot the blacks, poisoned their water holes, murdered them left, right and center, and those that were left were rounded up like dogs and cattle and stuck in these places called Aboriginal reserves, which were nothing less than concentration camps. And there they stayed until very recently. It's only 14 years since you people gave us the vote in this country, and we still have not got the land to give us economic independence. We need land rights, and we need it now. It's not good enough just to come and listen to music. If you people can afford the time to come to a Clash concert, then you can afford the time sometime soon when Aboriginal people march in this town for their land rights. Then you should be there. And I got one last thing to say. In October, there's going to be a lot of Aboriginal people going up to Queensland to protest at the Commonwealth Games. Now, the reason we're there is because in Queensland, Aboriginal people still are under that thumb of Joba Jockey Peterson, still have that same law that 14 years ago existed against us in this state. We want black people in Queensland to be free, have land rights. We want black people all over Australia to have land rights. And we want your support in Brisbane against the Games. Thank you.
That was Gary Foley on stage with The Clash when the band toured Australia in 1982. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia.
I was aware that, the generation that came before us, they weren't allowed to go to schools. And my mother, for instance, who I believe to be the most profound person in terms of influence in my life, she had this infinite wisdom that came from just living an essentially good life as an Aboriginal woman. But she was never allowed to go to school, so couldn't read or write, but she knew the power of knowledge, and she instilled in me that knowledge very early on in life. So I was always drawn to education and the development of a knowledge that was steeped in our culture and also gave us the potential to think more broadly about the world, our place in the world, and how we could change the world.
Speaking Out is produced by Jay McAllister and Sarah Allerley, and you can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au and find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Larissa Berendt. We'll be right back.